Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
But it's strange, even thinking about doing this pod. So I was thinking about when I used to work. I had a serious job in the ambulance service for a time before I was a comedian, and started thinking about that. But even then, putting the sort of sequence of events together, you suddenly think, hang on a second, I'm not as sure about that as I was yesterday. So to think, so it's an interesting one. And of course, the older you get, the more memories you accrue, and the more difficult it is to put them into a proper order. Although, of course, I do remember you and Ainsley Harriott doing your seminal impression of a pint of Guinness on stage, of course, which is a memory I will long cherish and never get out of my mind.
Welcome to the Humorology Podcast with me, Paul Barros, and my glittering lineup of guests from the worlds of business, sport and entertainment, who are here to share their wisdom and their use of humour with you. Humorology is the study of how humour can dramatically improve your business success and your life. Humorology puts the fun into business fundamentals, increases the value of your laughing stock, and puts a punchline back into your bottom line. Please remember to like, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This is the first episode of a two-parter. My guest on this edition of the Humorology Podcast is an award-winning comedian, writer, and podcast host. His highly acclaimed stand-up comedy has captivated crowds for decades, and he is the only comedian to perform in the Tower of London. In addition to his performing work on the stage and screen, he is a very, very successful scriptwriter for shows like They Think It's All Over, Never Mind the Buzzcocks, 8 Out of 10 Cats, Have I Got News for You, A League of Their Own, Strictly Come Dancing, The Graham Norton Show, BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and Children in Need, just to name a few. He is a BAFTA nominee and has won the Time Out Comedy Award, a Writers Guild Award, and a Sony Gold Award. When he's not performing stand-up or crafting comedic scripts, you can find him covering sports on multiple media channels, including BBC Two and Radio 4. Despite all of these hugely impressive accolades and the thousands of stars that he has worked with, the one thing that he is always most excited to talk about is his beloved Crystal Palace FC. Kevin Day, welcome to the Humorology Podcast.
Hello, Paul. Thank you for having me. Congratulations on that lovely run of puns at the top of the show. It's very good. And also, yes. It's Radio 5 I do sport. Radio 4's sports output is limited at the moment.
Oh, yeah. Damn, typo already.
That's all right. That's fine. I just like the idea of Radio 4 having some sport on it. I can't quite imagine how they would cover it. I keep telling Radio 3 they need more sport on there, but they don't listen, Paul.
Well, I mentioned Crystal Palace, which I'll come back to, because I'm very interested in how, from a humorology perspective, it enhances your well-being and your life. But I want to go back to the early days. You were brought up in southwest London, not far from me. And I've heard you regale people over the years with fascinating stories about your childhood. Is it true that your earliest memory is coming home from a football match, singing a humorous, somewhat colourful chant?
Yes, it is. I always say South London, Paul, as well, just in case people think I'm from Richmond, which wouldn't suit which wouldn't suit the image. I'm from the Streatham Tooting Ballers, which never used to have a name, but it's now called Graveney. by estate agents. It used to be up the road when I was a kid. Yeah, it's funny because I writing my book, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, it's memories that I cherished for years were severely challenged by talking to people about them in order to write the book. And I found, especially talking about Crystal Palace, all my friends entirely disagreed with stories and legends that I thought were set in stone. But I do distinctly remember, well, I certainly remember being told, my Uncle Bill took me to my first ever football match, which was Wimbledon, back in the day when they were a non-league team. And the story is that I came home from the game singing, 1-2, 1-2-3, bollocks to the referee. And my parents were so offended they wouldn't let him take me again, which is... It doesn't have a ring of truth about it, because there's Barry Cryer once said about my mum, she swore like a docker's parrot. She was very much of Irish peasant stock, so she would not have been offended by it. I suspect it's more the fact that Uncle Bill asked my dad for the ticket money that meant I wasn't taken again. But the other problem with Uncle Bill is, and this is true, he was on the fringes of organised crime. He used to claim that his brother was the craze third reserve getaway driver. Okay, so if the other two had a cold, his brother would be. But he was also a spiritualist medium, so he had a habit of, he would suddenly stop if I was out with him. I got on very well with him, but he would stop, or he would disappear. He once disappeared into a betting shop because he'd had a tip for the 2:30 at Kempton from Charles Dickens that came through. So he was an intro. But that, I know that was my first ever football game. That was at Wimbledon. I clearly had the time of my life. That's how I came home singing. So
actually, yeah. I wanted to come back to your family. Was humour actually valued as in your family? Was it important in status, or is it culturally important?
That's a very interesting question. There was lots of... I was an only child, but my mum had 10 brothers and sisters, so there was always people around, and certainly on the Irish side of the family. My dad's working class South London. He had a much smaller family, and his sister took themselves rather seriously, so laughter wasn't so much heard there. But certainly on the Irish side, laughter was something. There was the better you were at telling jokes, the more valued your company was. And I often wonder, thinking back, whether that's a lesson I subconsciously took on, because certainly, if you could sing in my mum's family, then you were always invited to parties. But all my mum's brothers were very funny, but it was never jokes that they told. It was always impossibly implausible shaggy dog stories that grew in the telling. But they're all masterful. Well, I look back on it, and even now when I talk to the two that are left, they're still brilliant storytellers. So, yeah, it was... I mean, that's not a conversation we would have had about whether humour was valued, but certainly... It was an important part of their family, and the better you were at telling stories. And again, I suppose you could get serious about this and say it goes back to a centuries old Irish tradition of telling stories around the fire, because it wasn't a literate society. My granddad couldn't read or write till his dying day, but was a very clever man. But certainly at school, I learned quite quickly, because I was quite bright. I was all right at sport, but nothing special. But I learned at school that not only being funny was quite good, but also being funny long after everybody else had stopped. So I used to get a grudging amount of respect, because I never read those signals when everybody else knew that the teacher was now fed up with my jocular impressions. I didn't read that, so I was forever getting into trouble for going too far. But it's that old clear. I never used comedy to avoid bullies, but I knew from quite an early age that if you could tell jokes or be funny, because I was always quite quick to make connections. If somebody said something, I was always quite quick to pick up something like that. I had a tendency to be quite sarcastic, which I still have, unfortunately. But yeah, it's certainly in the Irish side of the family, humour was a very valuable tool, because they weren't a family who ever spoke to each other in terms of actual conversations. They either sang to each other or they told each other jokes. There was no emotional depth. No one had a real chat. There might be some tears at a funeral, obviously, but they weren't the sort of family to sit down and talk about the world's problems. So, yeah, that's a very interesting question, yes. And the short answer is yes.
One of the things about the whole Humorology project is that how humour can be that ultimate bonding tool. But it sounds like you actually subliminally got that But it wasn't said, right, Kevin, you have to go out and learn three gags otherwise.
I think it can only have been subliminally. It's like I get asked to do these talking head shows quite a lot where, yeah, they'll look back at the 70s or the 80s and they'll say, yeah, what were your thoughts when you watched Steptoe and Son? And it's like, I have to be honest to say I didn't have any. And it's like they will show you an episode and you'll say, yeah, I remember that episode, but I don't remember at the time thinking this is a seminal piece of comedy. I don't remember thinking there's one particular Steptoe episode which I adore, which is where two prisoners escape from Wormwood Scrubs. And there's an old one and a young one, and their situation mirrors Steptoe and Son. Then they end up in Steptoe and Son's house, and there's not a laugh in it for the last 10 minutes. Now I will talk to you for an hour about how important that was. At the time, I probably would have been thinking there's no jokes in this. So there wasn't a time when I used to sit and watch comedy with my dad and go, oh, I love the way Benny Hill leers at that woman. Or, you know, it's only with hindsight that I realised how important it was. So it would have been subliminal. There would never have been a time where I sat down and thought to myself, oh, this is a good way of getting in with the family. Or one of my uncles never sat me on his knee and said, this is what you have to do. You have to get yourself some Shaggy Dog stories. You know, I'm only five. But certainly I think I must have picked up on how important humour was and how important it was as a way of communicating. And there was always a lot of laughter. I mean, my mum suffered very badly from depression, but she was always very happy when her family were around. There were always a lot. And it was interesting as well, because it was only the men that were funny. And I don't know, again, whether that was part of the 70s social thing in Ireland or in Anglo-Irish society, whether they weren't encouraged to be funny, but it was always the men who held court. And the women tended to be the ones who sang, basically. But it was. I do remember the joy of laughter. I never analysed it. I never just, you know, I never thought, now, which one of my uncles tells a story better? But it was certainly a very important part of family life, yes.
You brought up your mum, I've heard you talk about your ideas about depression and the fact that now everybody is saying they're depressed when, in fact, what they are is temporarily unhappy. And with my psychology hat on, I completely agree. But you're around and your mother suffered sometimes with very debilitating forms of depression. Do you think that, and you just touched on it, that humour can have a role in actually dealing with these kind of things?
I think so. I don't know how, as I'm not scientifically minded, but my mum's depression was such that, I mean, she was advised not to have children. So she was depressed before she had me, and then it was exacerbated by that. Her depression was such that for 6 months of every year, she was either in hospital or she'd locked herself in the back room. I remember being taken out of school because she'd had what they called shock treatment at the time, and the hospital wouldn't release her until there was somebody to look after, and that was me, and I was eight. But when she wasn't depressed, she was the best mum ever. She was brilliant. She was a bundle of energy and fun when she wasn't depressed, but it was kind of 6 months on, 6 months off. But even then, it was noticeable that she would visibly, even if she was poorly, if she was ill, and her family turned up, as they would sometimes in dribs or drabs, then she was always energized by that. And she would always have three or four good days after seeing her family, because she was very funny herself, but not in company. She was too sort of, not shy, but she would never sort of, she didn't really think it was a woman's place. Even up to the day she died, God love her, 5 years ago, she always thought that women should only be doing comedy if all the men who wanted to have a go had tried it, basically. She hated what I did for a living. She was always terrified for me. But yeah, it was interesting that she loved laughter. She loved laughing, and she loved her family being around. It might have been that her family was there, but she, you know, her family did seriously cheer up. But the way you introduced that, I do get quite cross, because having witnessed depression at first hand, I do get quite upset with people who, and I don't deny that anxiety, of course, this is a terrible world we live in at the moment. There are too many people who are too keen to claim depression when they're not depressed. They might be very sad, they might be very unhappy, but depression is a debilitating disease. The real depression is a shocking, awful debilitating disease, and this headlong rush for people to want to claim to be depressed slightly distresses me, and also because it takes up too much valuable time for the NHS as well. When people, and but I think what needs to happen is that people need to be given the tools to be aware of the fact that they're anxious, they're sad, they're worried, but that's not depression, basically. But at the moment, because we live in this terrible binary world, everyone goes, I'm either depressed or I'm not depressed, and there's nothing in between. And what we need to talk about are those things in between, so people can recognize where they are on that scale of depression, for want of a better word.
Yeah, and it's labeling, and it's I mean, from a psychological perspective, it's very interesting that when you give somebody a label, they tend to cling on to it, and therefore it becomes their reality, because and I do think it's dangerous to label people so much.
I've seen that, Paul, with a lot of friends of mine with their children, when they were so, you know, these are people, classic modern parents, both in jobs, where their children weren't particularly doing well in school, or perhaps were unhappy, various reasons. And they were so desperate for them to be diagnosed with something. They wanted there to be a reason why their kid wasn't particularly happy at school. And it might be that the kid's not academically minded and doesn't particularly want to be at school. But all of them, rather than think that perhaps the problem lies with them, all of them were desperate for the child to be labelled something and for the child to become... And of course, they all love their children dearly, but, you know, their life and their career were as important at the time as the children. And of course, they said, well, we're earning money to send him to private school. Well, perhaps he doesn't want to go to private school. Perhaps she doesn't want to do four languages. Perhaps she wants to play netball for a living. So as soon as there's a problem, they think, oh, God, well, they must be... Let's get them diagnosed with something, because then it's not my problem.
Well, and it's also that whole thing whereby, you know, you have to work under these parameters, and the parameters seem to have come in so much. You've got to get 10 GCSEs. You've got to do this. Right. And there's some people, I mean, we obviously mixed with a lot of them for our lives, who don't fit into any of those stereotypes.
Of course they don't. And it's, this is not a particularly good time to be middle-aged, Paul, to be honest, is it really? But
I think we're both young.
But I think this is a dreadful time to be young. Even before the pandemic, there's so much pressure on young people to look perfect. Everywhere they go, they're bombarded by images of perfect looking bodies. They're bombarded by images of people who are successful for no apparent reason. They're bombarded, you know, you have to get the, as you say, you've got to be successful. You've got to go to university. You've got to do this. And it's all you have to. You've got to. The choices have never been greater for young people, but at the same time, the things that the older people want them to do, as you say, have narrowed down so much. I mean, the idea that one of my friend's kids might want to be an apprentice would horrify them. Whereas 30 years ago, it was a perfectly valid thing to do. If a kid wasn't academically minded but liked cars, you'd go, oh, great, why not do an apprenticeship? Why not become a builder and decorator? You'll make a lot more money and you won't have to pay a student loan back. But no, it's no, you've got to do this. You know, especially middle-class families, which are mostly the ones we know, you've got to go to university, you've got to get this degree. And it's like I think my son was very brave, because he decided, a very bright, young, talented man, he decided at the age of 17 and a half that he didn't want to go to university. He thought he pretty much knew what he wanted to do with his life. He didn't think, you know, people, his teacher said to him, well, you've got to go to university to make contacts, to get a range of people that you, and he said, I already have, and why do I want to saddle myself with £50,000 worth of debt to basically make my phone book bigger, essentially? But at the time, it was a decision that I wasn't particularly happy with. I supported him. His mum wasn't particularly happy with, but you just go, oh, fine. And it turns out that he was absolutely right, and his life has not been, is no richer than it would have been had he gone to college. He trusted that he would get opportunities in the world of acting and comedy without having to go to university and join a drama club to do so. And now it may be that 10 years down the line, when all the people that he would have been at university with are then running BBC Light Entertainment, he might regret that decision in 10 years' time. But I don't think he will. But even the fact that we're talking about it being a brave decision is a strange conversation to have. He's a young man who's always known his own mind. He was a professional choir boy. He was in a choir called Libera, who were well known across the world. He sang with the Beach Boys, sang for the Pope. And at the age of 11, he said, "I want to leave the choir." And most of my social life at the time was down to the choir. And I said, "Well, we don't know. Stay in the choir. We love the choir." He said, "No, you love the choir." He said, "But I don't want to be the boy," because he was on the front of the latest two CDs being the cute cherubic one. He said, "I don't want to be the boy that gets taller and ends up at the back of the CD cover with the surly scowl." And he said, I want to go to school and be a normal schoolboy. I don't want to be the kid that's in the choir and has to." And he said, "I've been all over the place." But that was a really brave decision to make. And so it's again, it was a decision we didn't particularly want him to do, but you have to allow them to do it. And it seems to me that young people, and I know we're very way off the subject here, but young people, it seems to me, whilst being under this extraordinary pressure, are discouraged from making their own decisions about their own lives. And I think there's so... It's so hard being young these days. It really is, even financially. My son likes to think of himself as a new Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce doesn't want to be living at home, but he can't afford not to be. It's simply because even where I live in my part of South London, rents are exorbitantly high, and it's ludicrous. When we were young, we would share a flat. If you were still living at home at the age of 18 when we were young, there was something wrong. But if you moved out, you shared a flat, you squatted, you did whatever, the accommodation was so much cheaper. And I really feel for young people. And again, it's like business people, young people are not really, they don't learn about business. That's one of the, because I'm a trustee of the Crystal Palace Foundation, which is a role I'm very proud of. And there are all sorts of things. And social mobility is one of our big things for young people, because there are people in Croydon who've never been to London. And we reach out to young people. Yeah, we try and create studio space. We get them in. We've got all sorts of community projects going on. But one of the things that we picked up on 2 years ago is that people were saying, "Yeah, you can if you play football, you can get out of this situation. If you can box, you can get out of this situation. If you can sing or dance, you can get out of this situation." And we looked around and said, "Well, what about the 95% of kids who can't do that?" So we looked for role models for them in amongst local businesses. So we got people who were running, even if it was like a bakery or a big corporation, we got them in to talk to a lot of the kids in the area, just to show to them that there are all sorts of ways to improve your social mobility. And that because you're from Croydon, and because you've been labelled by the rest of the country as being from Croydon, therefore of no real value to society, doesn't mean that you can't have aspirations and hopes and ideas, and here are the people to prove it, you know. And so it took us until 2 years ago to work out that business was an important way out for people as well.
100%. But and one of the things, and which does, funny enough, this does all tie into the whole humorology project, is about lightness of touch, how you behave in certain situations. I'm on work with a couple of social enterprises that do similar things. One have So You Want to Be in TV. There is no social media, but you've worked in TV forever, as have I. How much social mobility do you see in TV?
Again, that's a really interesting question, because I talk to a lot of people, and the thing about being a trustee of the foundation is that they don't want to talk to me, right? These are mainly young black and Asian kids. They don't want granddad turning up. So what we have are a whole range of young people. We call it the power of the badge. There's a whole range of young black and Asian staff that we have at the foundation who wear the Crystal Palace badge, and that gets them in. You know, we have this brilliant scheme where every Friday and Saturday night at three police stations in Croydon, one of our councillors goes to the police station to be there for kids that have been arrested for the first time, to talk to them about what brought them there. And two of those kids in the past 2 years now work for the foundation, so which I think is remarkable. We do a lot of stuff with around gangs and all that, but the social mobility thing is really interesting, because most people that we work with, and we work with at the moment about 13,000 kids across the borough, I would say probably three or four of them would think that there's a chance that they could ever work in TV. Because it's a work that, and what's happened in TV is that, quite rightly, the broadcasting companies and the production companies have worked out that on screen we need to reflect the society we live in. So there are a lot more black and Asian people and women presenting TV shows. This is exactly how it should be. But when you go to the studio, you don't see any black faces. Yeah. You see very few black cameramen, very few black producers, and I mean on the fingers of one hand, very few black directors, still mostly white middle-class people. There are companies like Zeppotron, Richard Osman's company, who, to their enormous credit, pay their junior staff, because there are a lot of production companies who shamefully still don't pay interns or runners or whatever you want to call them. So what happens is the only kids who get those jobs are the kids whose parents can afford for them to do it or know somebody in the production company. So there are companies that are starting to realise that society needs to be reflected behind the screen. But no, social mobility is still... The fact that it's 2022 and we're still having to work at it is shocking, but it still exists, and people still talk to me. I've never really had a chip on my shoulder, but there is still an issue with class in this country. There's no doubt about it. And
it's maintained for a reason, is so that the people at the top can get all the jobs for their own children.
That damages out the rest of society, because you all know yourself the amount of talent and energy that we have in our area is going untapped. And these are kids that will end up with their own mental health problems, because they are kids who feel that there's nowhere for them to go. But these are kids with ideas, with energy, with enthusiasm. And we're missing out on that. And you all know that yourself. And that's got to change as well.
But here's how I think it can change. And the only way it can change, because everybody's doing a sop towards, you know, we want more people of this ethnicity or this thing, rather than actually going out into the community and giving the skill sets they need so that they will be comfortable when they enter into those places. Yeah. And that's the key for me, is it's all very well, we're going to take one of these, we're going to put them in situ. Well, actually, if they haven't got the skill sets, which includes communication skills, whereby you feel comfortable in there, it's never going to work. The marriage is never going to happen. And I'm very passionate about the fact that you can't just do it. You have to do it from the baseline level. I'm very happy to come and talk to your people if it helps.
Yeah, absolutely.
About here's some communication skills that work on every level, and that's what you have to be able to do. And humor is part of that. By the way, if you can make the managing director laugh wherever you're from, it evens out everything.
I couldn't agree more. There are two things off the back of my dad, God rest his soul, who I lost recently, who I was very, very close to. He taught me to read at the age of four, because he said it might come in handy. And as it happened, reading has always been my passion. My headmaster at primary school loved me, because at the age of seven, I had a reading. Age of 14, I used to drive my mum up the wall because she wanted me climbing trees and having fights, not reading books during summer holidays. But reading's always been really important. And my dad always said to me, never lose your accent, but you need to speak the same language as the people that are giving you jobs when you grow up. Yeah, so, and that was a really important lesson. But that thing with human bosses, I'm in a really happy situation, because I've been doing my job for long enough as a writer that I can take the piss out of the producers, right? They know me, and I can take the piss out of them. And I always try and do it in front of the junior staff, because they never get the chance to do that. So yeah. I will always, you know, if there's a crowded office, that's when I will take the opportunity to jokingly say to the producers, the money you pay these people is shocking. You should be ashamed of yourself going back to your 12-bedroomed house with your car made of gold. Because it's just nice. It's a tension release, because it's great to hear the junior staff laughing. And I think you're absolutely right. But that idea... It's also a risky one. I mean, if you're just making your way in the industry, in any industry, the idea that you're going to try and make your boss laugh is a kind of 50-50 situation. Because if it works, fine. If it doesn't, you're probably in trouble. There's also that fine line between making somebody laugh, I've found, and taking the piss out of them. And I've always found that you have to... It's as a friend of mine, God love him, Dave Ricketts, he's got the most preposterous West Country, he's from Gloucester. If he was in a sitcom playing a character from Gloucester, you'd say, mate, dial the accent down a little bit, which is nobody talks like that. He's also obsessed with badgers. He's the most peaceful man you've ever met in your life, but he turned a table over in a pub once because me and a friend were blaming badgers for bovine TB, and he just went, "You don't, you people, you don't know anything about badgers, you bloody, you townies, you oh terrible, oh did it." But I once said to him, "I only really take the piss out of people I like," and he went, "Well, you must bloody love me then, because you take the piss out of me all the time." I think that's because of it, but it's that fine line of getting. It's an odd thing where you get to know someone. And again, I've always thought it's a very South London thing, but I think it's a very working class thing, is that people, if people come to the pub we drink in before Palace games, where we go, as Ali, my wife, says, who you know, basically we go, as she says, to sit at the same table in the same corner, talking the same bollocks to the same people that you have done for 25 years, which is part of the process. But if a friend of a friend comes along for the first time, they must sometimes think these people don't like each other at all, because all they're doing is taking the piss out. But that's a reflection of how much we love each other and how much that we've known each other for so long, that we have all these shared experiences, we have all these shared buzzwords. And yet, rather than show affection in front, you know, individually, if I'm with one of them, we will hug and we will talk about things in life. But as a group, we show our affection as a community by literally taking the piss out of each other and reminding each other of terrible failures of the past, which never fails to make us laugh, which again is something that a psychologist would be looking at. But that the power of laughter is I'm fascinated by it, but I'm also fascinated by the fact that it only needs to go wrong by one degree and somebody's going home really unhappy. They might laugh around the table, but we instinctively know the things that you can't tease people about.
That's really about actually understanding that, first of all, you have to gain rapport with people in order do that. So that is the huge communication. That comes from confidence. You know, why is everybody in this current shower of a parliament gone to public school and everything? Because they're taught this confident air and everything. And then they're taught communication models, which are, you know, we learnt these in different ways, but you have to start. I always say you start by listening, but you listen with the eyes and you're looking at people and going, has this pissed you off? No, you know I'm teasing when I say this. You know we're playing a little game, but it's a very important part. I agree, you can't just go in and do it, which is why you need, why I think education is so important in the broader scale, not about getting exams and everything. How do people communicate? When have you ever heard of anybody at school getting lessons in communication?
That's really interesting. That concept of listening with the eyes is a fascinating one as well. I suppose it's sort of, you'd call it reading the room, but that's a really, because I suppose a teacher would say that, well, of course, everything is about communication because we're talking all the time. But you're right, in terms of actually teaching people to communicate. And what I find interesting about being, and again, coming back to my group of friends, it's like there's a couple of them with failed marriages that we know we can take the piss out of them because they're happily married now. There's a couple with failed marriages. There's a few with unfailed marriages, I have to say, but we wouldn't take the piss out of them because we know that it was serious and upsetting. But what's interesting as well about that group communication is when you're in a room, a dressing room, for example, or if you're in, I was in a writing room recently with a large group of comedians. After about 5 minutes, when everyone sort of established themselves, they tend not to be funny, hilarious, because comics, when they're in each other's company, the pressure is off to be funny. We all respect the fact that we're funny. As soon as a muggle comes in, a civilian, a non-committed, as soon as they come in, immediately, if there's eight comics in the room who have been chatting quite amiably about history or politics or family without the need to make people laugh, as soon as a non-comedian comes in, all eight of those people will start to want to make that person laugh. And it takes a bit of confidence to not want to do that. I'm not that sociable, oddly. Ali's very sociable. She loves having people around. So my dad was exactly the same as me when he's my age. If my mum had people around, around about 9 o'clock, he would turn the fish tank lights off. That was his first cue that they should probably be going. Then he would start winding the alarm clock. And then eventually, if he was fed up, he would just turn the lights off and leave them in the dark. But what I can do, if I come home to a house full of people, I'm very good because I can actually take the piss out of them, but they don't. Ali knows what I'm doing, but they don't. And they think, oh, he's just being funny when he says, oh, for the love of God, what are you doing in my house? They laugh because they think, and I am being funny. But it's Simon Mayer once said to me, I love having you as a guest, but you're obsessed. He called it the tyranny of the punchline. He said, you're obsessed with having the last word. And every subject we talk about, no matter how serious, you're always looking for a funny angle out of it. And I can see your mind working. And the thing is that you say it out loud. We're live on radio and you will say it. And the fact is, you're interesting enough without having to make people laugh. You've proved yourself as a human being. And that was a really good lesson for me. And it was kind of brave of Simon to say that to me, really, because he just said, look, it's great, you're funny. We believe you're funny. We know you're funny. You don't have to keep proving it. And I actually found myself enjoying being a guest on his show so much more after that. It's like I'm doing Talk Sport this afternoon. I love live radio. It's one of my favorite mediums. I love podcasts. I think podcasts are the most democratic thing that's happened to broadcasting in years. I think podcasts are brilliant. And if somebody young and new asked me to do a podcast, I will always do it. So I think it's important to encourage people. And again, that comes back to teaching communicate. Doing podcasts is a way for young people to communicate that they never had before. And it's amazing, the preferred podcast. But I enjoy doing things like live radio so much more now that I have the confidence to let an obvious punchline go by. I have the confidence to let somebody else be funny. I have the confidence to let somebody else speak for a minute or so, knowing that when I do get my chance to speak, I'll be good at it. But it took me a long time to learn that lesson. And if Simon Mayo hadn't told me that, I would have spent the first 30 minutes of this podcast trying to make you laugh. Which, you know, it's failed dismally so far. But that's what I would have been trying to do. And I sometimes find it wearing when you're in the company of people who just can only communicate through jokes, through laughter, and have no other communication skills. And when it's time to talk seriously, they're sort of lost.
But isn't the essence of great comedy comes out of truth? That's always right. And also, does the truth go down easier with a joke attached to it? So there's both sides of that. It comes down to actually understanding that the truth is powerful.
It is. I mean, I think if you were to watch Tim Vine, for example, who's a comic I admire greatly because can't write one-liners, but I don't know whether you'd say there's much truth in that comedy. I think in everyday life, in terms of business, in terms of when you're talking to producers or people, I think humour helps because, for example, if a producer says, we can only offer you this much money because the budget's low, you know, if I wasn't a comedian, I'd go, oh, fine, OK, well, I'll take it. But as a comedian, I can go, well, you would say that. Of course you would say that. We know that's not true, but I can say it in a funny way.
Yeah.
If you sort of mean. So it is a useful tool. I think the idea of comedy speaking truth to people is a very interesting one, especially as a comedian, obviously, but it's got to be funny. People used to hate a lot of alternative comics used to dismiss Jongleurs. Remember Jongleurs in Clapham, which had this reputation. But it had a reputation of being the yuppies paradise, and they hated it. They're all yuppies. I loved it because I always found you could talk about anything. You could take the mickey out of our posture. You could talk about any subject, no matter how serious, but you had to make it funny because it says comedy on the door. And as a comedian, if you don't make it funny, then you're not a comedian, you're just a lecturer. And it's important to be funny. And I found, and I'm talking about really serious subjects, abortion, politics, all sorts of stuff. As long as you're funny, you can say almost anything. There are things I wouldn't talk about on stage, but as long as you're funny, audiences will understand that. And also the other thing as well that I always, and I think this comes from the fact I did go to university, but I was chucked out after 6 weeks. So I worked in the real world. So I understand that come Friday, Saturday, people in the real world look forward to dressing up, going to a comedy club. And I don't think we should be taking the piss out of those people. I couldn't stand comics, compares especially, who would literally go along the front row taking the piss of how they looked, what clothes they were wearing, how old they were. And it's just like, no, our job is to make them laugh. It's not to use them as the butt of laughter for everybody else. And as a comic, that's what we should be doing. It's a job, and it's a job I take really seriously. It's a job I love, but it's our job to make people laugh. And we should be, the targets of our comedy should be people above us. You know, this old cliche about punching up.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Thanks for that. And that's what we should be doing. We shouldn't be taking the piss out of people that have probably had a hard week at university or at work or are unemployed and who have come out for some light relief. But that light relief can be anything. You can talk about anything again, but it has to be funny. And again, I think that's where in business, it's always difficult, I think, for people to work out where humour can be used. I mean, it's different in if you're a trainer, for example, then you can sort of plan where am I going to use comedy in this training module? Is it appropriate? Are the people I'm talking to appropriate? When I was working at the ambulance service, I started off as a clerical officer because the NHS in those days, oddly, you started as an officer and you ended up as an assistant. So I started as a clerical officer, but I ended up as a principal administrative assistant after 7 years. So I was quite high up in the pecking order. And we were industrial relations and recruitment. So we would do industrial relations modules for senior uniformed officers, most of whom were in their 50s and 60s, most of whom were ex-army. And it didn't take me long to realise that humour was the least appropriate thing for those people. The last thing they wanted was this little bloke who looked like he'd stepped off the stage of a New Order, being in a training room with them, trying to make them laugh about the new employment law, the new Employment Act, or the new Health and Safety Act. It didn't work. And to the extent that eventually I twigged, and I used to make them laugh at the start by basically going, "You don't want to be here. I know that. You're all stuck in your ways. You all think you know best. Let's acknowledge that. And let's come out of here in an hour with a smile on our faces so everybody else thinks, oh, that went well." So acknowledging that really works. Acknowledging the fact that that was a situation in which humour wasn't appropriate actually became humorous in a strange sort of way. Whereas with new recruits or new officers, humor was really appropriate. And so, for example, with new officers, we had this like officer induction training stuff that we would do. And I would say to them, look, these are some of the real-time issues you're going to face as a new officer. You've been on the ambulances for quite some time. You're stepping up into a new role. You're now the enemy for some of the people who were your friends. You're now dealing with these other officers. And we would do impressions of the other officers that they were going to deal with, which always went down really well. So it's a question about, so it comes back to you listening with your eyes about reading the room. But there are some people, probably even now, who say, well, there's no room for humour in communication, in training modules. But the other thing you learn as well is that every job has its own different type of humor. It's like one of my closest friends is still a paramedic. I got him the job back in the day, basically. But you learn from working in the ambulance service and being amongst ambulance crew and firemen as well, that they have the blackest, bleakest sense of humor, but they have to, because they're not going to get through the day unless they can distance themselves from what they've seen and what they've done. They're never going to sleep at night without the aid of alcohol. So they find a way, and their mechanism is humor, because they have to sort of dehumanize the people they've dealt with. And that sounds horrible, but it's partly why they're so good at their job. If they start to get wrapped up with the people there, you know, if they start to think, I wonder what happened to that old lady that I took in this afternoon, again, they won't be able to function. So they use humor amongst themselves, only amongst themselves. They'll never do it in front of family or friends or people that are crying, but amongst themselves, it's black, it's bleak, but it's fully understandable. But you would never share that outside. And every group, people who work, milkmen, I'm sure, had their own jokes, their own cliches, their own buzzwords. Postmen, probably the same thing. Nurses, it's really interesting. It's really interesting how you have to contain that humor and make sure it doesn't cross over. Yeah.
Well, is it appropriate in certain places? I mean, I spent 2.5 years training doctors at Guy's King's and St. Thomas's, and actually the surgeons, you know, some of the blackest humor you've ever seen, but that's life and death. We had on the pod, we had John Sweeney, who has been in 61 now, because he's just coming back from Kyiv, war zones, and he says, in order to survive, you need that. You have to have a release valve, because I mean, humor is that release valve on that level. In London Ambulance Service, you know, they're seeing horrendous things.
Of course, but that's really interesting what you say about the surgeons, because one of the very many reasons why I love the NHS, and the last but one Edinburgh show I did was about the NHS and my wife, because when my wife, she was very ill a few years ago, as you know, properly very ill, not sure how this is going to play out, ill. But her medical team, her doctors, her surgeons, her nurses, understood that my way of coping with that was humour. They didn't always laugh, but they understood what I was trying to do. And part of the reason I did that show was to explore why an articulate, intelligent man like me still couldn't talk about it properly, that I had to make that my release at the time. So it used to drive Ali up the wall, because where she saw medical team, I saw audience. So we would be in these really serious meetings, and the nurse would, out of context, this doesn't sound remotely funny, but one of the nurses said that this treatment that she's having, we're putting her on straight away, Ali will probably lose her hair. And I went, oh, what, everywhere? Like, fingers crossed. And to her enormous credit, she said, yes, it won't grow back if she moves to Wolverhampton. And then brilliantly, the nurse then said to me, and by the way, this treatment is, her hormones are going to be all over the place. You won't be able to have sex for 2 years. And I went, really? She went, no. But Ali said to ask, to tell you that. Right, so she knew, yeah. But these people knew, they made allowances for the fact that my fear, my terror, was masked by comedy. They understood that. They didn't think for a moment I was being flippant or I didn't care. There was one afternoon, it was a Saturday afternoon, Palace were involved in a relegation struggle, and it just so, I was in hospital with Ali, and it just so happened that the doctor had said to Ali, you can go home for a week. And literally, as the doctor told her that, I had the radio on, Palace scored a goal in the last second of injury time, and I started running around the ward, going, yes, brilliant. And the doctor went, I haven't even told him you're coming out yet. And she said, that's nothing to do with me. He's listening to football. But they understood that was like, and then because the doctor said, oh, I really thought you were happy. I said, and when he said, Ali's coming home, I said, that's brilliant news. I can watch Match of the Day tonight. Fantastic. But they understood that it wasn't flippancy. It wasn't cruelty. More importantly, Ali understood that. The eyebrows would raise every now and again. And thank God, and the NHS, Ali's well and happy again. But even now, there are times when we're in company that Ali will give me the odd dig and say, you know, no, don't. That she knows that I'm about to say something about somebody, she'll just go, no, don't do it. Which is great, because even now I still need reminding that there are times when it's not appropriate. But what I thought was wonderful, one reason I did that show was to explore how humour is important, even in the darkest of circumstances. We all know my dad's funeral in November was, I haven't laughed so much in years. And there was 200 people there. It started at 11 in the morning. The last one left my house at 2 in the following morning. And it was brilliant. Dad went into the music from The Good, the Bad and the Ugly. The priest, because my dad was deaf, the priest had a megaphone to so he could hear it. And there were one or two people who thought that was inappropriate. My dad had this thing for the Virgin Mary. He was a late convert to Catholicism. And his view was, I might as well not go to a Catholic church as not go to an Anglican one. But he actually got quite into it the older he got, and he loved the Virgin Mary. And when he moved in with us, much to Ali's chagrin, he gaffer taped a picture of the Virgin Mary in his room, which is the gaffer tape bit that Ali didn't like, not the Virgin Mary bit. But the priest, Father Frank, and Father Frank is the son of Jimmy Cricket. Remember the comedian from it? So Father Frank understands humour. So Father Frank did this hilarious oratory in which he ended up ripping off his cassock to reveal an old palace shirt with the word Virgin on it, who he used to be sponsored by, with a picture of the Virgin Mary gaffer taped underneath it, which was just absolutely fantastic. And it set the tone for the rest of the day. But there were one or two people, one of my aunts, for example, said that was shocking. And I just went, no, it wasn't. It's exactly what Dad would have wanted. It made everybody laugh. And we've all known that experience of laughing at funerals. And it's incredibly cathartic. And that day, obviously, it was followed by many days of sadness. I'm still dealing with it now. But the actual day itself, but it was really risky for Father Frank to do that. He checked with us beforehand that it was all right to be lighthearted. So we went, as I said afterwards, it's a long way from lighthearted to having a picture gaffer taped underneath your cassock, which he revealed like a strippogram. But it was brilliant and it was perfect. And it was exactly in context. But if you tell people that, it sounds, even now telling you, it sounds odd. And there will be people going, well, that sounds a really weird funeral. But then as soon as we got back to the pub where the funeral was heard, that's all people were talking about. People going, oh, that's fantastic. That's really funny. And then that gets conversations going. And of course, everyone starts sharing stories. Ed did an impromptu speech, sharing stories. You tell those stories that most of the people in the room have heard before anyway about Dad's exploits, but you still laugh at them. And yet it's really odd. The idea that you laugh at a funeral is a strange, written down, that's a strange pitch, isn't it? That people
laugh. It is, but actually psychologically it does make perfect sense, because I mean, I think that humour is the ultimate state change tool. So when people are really in the depth of something, if you can actually make them laugh, it changes the whole brain chemistry of what's going on. And so you can actually look at something in a different way, because what is humour? It's looking at it in a different way. So if you can, well, that's why I would say, and I wonder if you would agree, that humour is a superpower in that sense, because it changes everything on a fundamental level.
I do agree, but again, it comes back to a conversation we had. As long as it's used correctly, as long as people who are funny are responsible with it, because it's also, whilst I agree with everything you say, it's also very easy to use humour for cruelty, to use humour to undermine, to use humour to tease and to bully. But this idea of parameters, you know, because I think it's wonderful that the president of Ukraine is a comedian. But I often wonder whether he's told, when he's doing these powerful, moving speeches from a bunker somewhere, whether his aides are saying, don't end with a knock-knock joke. It's not appropriate. Because he clearly, knowing comedians as we do, we know that he will see the humour in the situation that's going on. We know that every muscle in his body is aching to take the piss out of Putin. He's probably desperate. Every time he's on telly or talking to the United Nations, he probably wants to do an impression of Putin, but it really wouldn't be appropriate, except it might be the thing. I thought was one, the Eurovision Song Contest, which I watched from start to finish for the first time in my life ever, I thought was a wonderful actually exciting occasion, and the music was fantastic, but also the fact that I heard the following morning they interviewed the Ukrainian version of Graham Norton from about, because the TV studio has been destroyed. He commented on the Eurovision Song Contest to those people that still have electricity and TVs, and he said that winning the Eurovision Song Contest, he said the people of Europe, said when your friends are unhappy, you give them a hug. And he said what happened last night was that Europe gave us a hug, and he said that, and the whole of Ukraine feels that. And in the same way, that equates to humor, because the people of Russia, Putin, will be furious at that concept, furious at the concept that there's love and effect. And that's what humor can do. Humor can, in most circumstances, humor can, when it's inclusive, when it's used for the right reasons, humor is, as you say, a superpower. It really is. And there are times as well when you practice humor, there are times, not always on stage, but, and you all know this yourself from performing, you know that feeling. Initially, that feeling 15 seconds, I still get stage fright, but that feeling, first of all, 15 seconds in, when you think, this is going to be fine, this is great, let's enjoy this, let's relax. But also that feeling when you've got a minute to go and you know that the last thing you're going to say ties up everything and it's clever and it's funny, you know the response you're going to get, and you just enjoy it so much. You almost enjoy that anticipation more than the actual release. Then, of course, the problem is that 10 minutes later, you're still buzzing, you're still high, you still want to talk about it. It drives Ali out the wall, because if Ed and I got a gig at the same time, we both come home testosterone-fueled monsters, kicking the door in, racing to tell her first how good our gigs were. But that feeling of being able to share laughter is an amazing thing, and I'm aware that it's a powerful thing to be able to do, and I love doing it. But I'm also very aware that I mentioned the fact I can be sarcastic earlier. I'm very aware that there are probably people in the past that I've hurt or upset or without meaning to do so. But so I have to think very carefully about the next thing I say. So I've become very good. It's taken me a long time, but I'm very good at judging when and where and how far you can go. And I think that's easy for me to do in a comedy context or in a social context, because I'm a professional comedian. When you've come to try and doing it in a business context, that's why I'm fascinated by your podcast, because that's where I find it really, how do you judge when it's appropriate? As when I was ended up as a boss, I had my own little, I was very proud, I had my own little office, and there's a big office off my own little office, and I had 8 staff directly underneath me. I used to love the sound of laughter. I used to love it if I could hear them laughing, right? Because I trusted, they're a really good team of people. I used to love hearing the laugh, but I had to really forcibly restrain myself from going out and joining in, right? Because by that time I'd started being a comedian, so the two were overlapping. I thought I was hilarious, but I used to have to go, no, it would ruin it for them if I start going out, you know, Simon Brentstone, say, oh, what are we laughing at, guys, and then join in. So you have to let them get on with it, secure in the knowledge that they will get on with it once they've stopped laughing about whatever they're laughing about. And it could have been that they were laughing about me, but it's that there couldn't be a better indicator, I think, of a healthy company, that there are people laughing in it and the boss is not there. So they're not laughing because you've said something witty or you've made a pun. They're laughing because they're happy-ish in the process. Yeah, and again, for a lot of people doing jobs, you know, monotonous, not just jobs like the fire service or ambulance service or police, but monotonous jobs with just completely repetitious jobs, for them, humour again is another great release. And I always think this idea that there should be a silent workforce is a ludicrous one. People should be allowed to chat and communicate and talk. If you're on the phone all day trying to sell insurance to people, you should be encouraged to every third phone call. You should be encouraged to have 5 minutes off just to stretch your legs, but also to talk to other people in the room, because otherwise people are just internalising at work, and you don't want that from anybody.
Well, isn't great leadership about creating a culture whereby appropriate laughter and appropriate fun can flourish?
It's not only about creating that culture, it's about having the common sense and the confidence to let it flourish on its own. It's about walking away from it. In the same way that I could always go, if I had to go off site to a divisional headquarters or whatever, I went off-site secure in the knowledge that when I got back, anything that needed to be done would have been done. Right? And I was always quite happy. If the work was done, if come about 4:30, I would say to people, go off, go. It's like, I find it, there are still so many production companies, there's still so many TV companies who have this macho thing that you've got to be the last one out. Right? And as a writer, I will always make I'll make it funny, that come around 6:00, I will make a point of getting up in a funny fashion, packing my stuff and saying, I'm off now, my contractual hours are done. This and I've spoken to quite a few producers and said to them, you're going about this the wrong way, because it's fine for you to say, right, you know, we've got to be here till 10:00. There's a car waiting for you outside the office to take you home. These people have got to get public transport, they've got to get home. By the time they get home, they've got to go straight to bed to come in the morning, because you've got to be first in the morning. It's not productive.
It's not for creativity.
It's not for creative, but for any job, it's not productive.
Any job, no, but I think any job is creative. You see, I think the idea that, you know, if you work in media, you are creative, and if you work in a factory, you are not. Because, by the way, the best factories are getting people to put in ideas about how they could streamline. That's a creative process, as far as I'm concerned.
You know, the other thing, my dad was full of good advice. He's a very wise man in his working class South London way, very wise man. But when I joined the ambulance service, I'd been thrown out of university. I was the first one in my extended family to go to university and the first one thrown out. And my mum always throughout my life offered me unconditional support, but she was very unhappy at me getting thrown out. I went to Reading University to study archaeology. First day there, I met this mature student, fell madly in love. Went to one lecture, didn't get a trowel, so I was really cross because I thought we'd be digging stuff straight away. And then, so basically, at the end of the first term, they said, "Look, you've just not been here." And I said, "Well, I'm in love, man." It's like, so they asked me to leave university. My mum was devastated. So then I worked in a building site for a while. I had a succession of minor jobs, and I got this job as a clerical officer at the ambulance service. And I was pretty low about this as well. And mum was like, "This is what you've thrown away, this promising career. You're a clerical." And my dad just went, "Is it the lowest grade?" I said, "Yeah, it's the lowest grade you can possibly get. It's clerical." And he said, "Be the best clerical officer you can. Just go into work in the morning with a smile on your face. Do that job to the best of your ability. If there's other stuff you can do, say, is there anything else I can do?" And it was such good advice, because that's what I did. And I immediately started to enjoy it. I felt part of a team. I felt that I was productive. And I think that's part of the reason why I started to progress up the ranks. But that was fantastic advice, because without that advice from Dad, I would have been just a surly youngster doing just what he had to do to get along, and probably would have ended up leaving that job as well and gone into something else. But it's really good advice.
Well, I think from a humorology perspective, and what we're talking about is giving people business advice as well about how to think. I think that is perfect, because, I mean, I sent my... son in when he did work experience first before going to drama school, and he now works every weekend and everything. It is that same advice: go around, be nice to everybody, say, "Is there anything I can do?" And that the Humorology Project is about being nice to people, being actually having some humility, having some humanity, having some humor in the general sense. And that's the people you want around you.
One of the best bits of advice I got when I first started, I still call myself a stand-up comedian, even though most of my comedy work is writing. But the first show I worked on properly was a disastrous, chaotic mess of a show called Saturday Zoo, hosted by Jonathan Ross, which was live on Channel 4. And the fact it was live, but we had huge guests on. We had proper huge guests. But I remember being in the writing room for the first time, and it just ended up just me and Jonathan. It was the first writing room experience I'd had. And I'd known Jonathan for a while anyway, but I also said, "Jonathan, this is all new to me, this world. Have you got any advice?" And he said, "Yeah, always say thank you to the person who brings you your tea." And it's a brilliant piece of advice, because he said, for two reasons. He said, A, it's the right thing to do. B, the person bringing you your tea in 5 years' time could well be a producer. So it's the right thing to do in terms of your career. But it's also, and that's what I always say to people, say please and thank you. It makes it makes such a difference. I went to see a show last night at the Festival Hall that my wife's working with, Fascinating Aida. It's a brilliant show. But as I'm taking my seat, obviously the seat was in the middle of a row, so I'm very sorry, everybody. I know I'm being a terrible nuisance. And they got up and I said, thank you, thank you. And this elderly gentleman went, that's the first time anybody said thank you to me in weeks. And it just makes a difference. And it makes a difference to the people around you as well. And it takes nothing to do it. And it's the same with, I can't stand performers or comedians who won't sign autographs, who won't talk to people after gigs. It's like, well, what are you doing it for? And it takes you, I remember doing a show with Danny Baker, who I'd absolutely got on well with as a pilot. It was terrible. It didn't get picked up, and rightly so. But there were people afterwards who wanted to chat. And you know, I love chatting to people who've seen the show. And there's one chap who wanted Danny Baker's autograph. And Danny Baker just gave him this 5-minute lecture about how shallow his life must be, that he needed it validating by having a stranger's name written down on a piece of paper. And I just said to Danny, the length of time it took you to say that, you could have just signed his piece of paper and moved on. It's like I did the podcast that we've started to do a live show. We did one in Accrington.
It's a brilliant podcast, by the way.
Thank you very much. But we had 200 people there in a small room in Accrington. And most of them, a lot of them had bought us presents and gifts, which was great. But most of them wanted to chat after. So it took us 2 hours to get out. But there's a bar, so I don't mind. But it's part of the thing. I love people coming up and telling me how important the pod is to them. And it's the same as a comedian. If you're doing a gig and you come out of the show, you go to the bar and people want to say to you, oh, that was great, I really liked it. And occasionally somebody would say, I've got an issue with what you said. And you'd go, well, fine, well, let's talk about it. Or you have to be open. But this idea that you come off stage and you no longer are part of it. And yeah, admittedly, my level of fame is such that I'm not swamped by thousands of people. So I don't know what it's like to be that level of fame, how much of a nuisance that is. But I love the attention. We're all in the business because we want attention. And I don't think you can be on stage for an hour with the people have paid money to pay attention to you. You then can't say to them, I've had your attention. You no longer exist to me. It's part of the job. It goes with the territory. You talk to them and you talk to them and you end up enjoying the conversation. And if people want to say, I really enjoyed that, thank you very much. I'm only too happy to do that. I don't understand this. So communication for all of us has to be a two-way street. And I often found that with other people, with training modules, for example, I often thought, even when I was doing them, I often thought afterwards, they probably learned more in the half hour cup of tea. You'd always have a half hour session afterwards with a cup of tea and a biscuit or whatever. Mm-hmm. I probably learned more about the job from talking to the ambulance officers in that bit than they probably learnt about the Employment Act of 1985 in the bit that I'd been doing. And what would happen then is that in that conversation afterwards, they would ask you specific questions. They would say, to the extent that we eventually ended up changing the modules, because they would say, look, it's fine you telling us about the Employment Act. It's fine you telling us what's in it. But what we need to know is how that works on a daily basis. How does it affect this situation? So then you start introducing things like role play, because then you anticipate the situations that they most want to talk about. And it's very difficult, I found, to get senior ambulance officers to take part in role play. So you would draft people in from the office to play these roles. But because what they wanted was a practical example of how these things worked. They didn't want to know that if somebody was made redundant, then this was now the rule. They wanted to know how you tell someone that they're being made redundant. You wanted to know how you coped with that, with their immediate emotional aftermath. And these were things that I discovered we weren't telling them how to do. So I've found myself as when I did training modules that I was learning more from them, as I say. And I found that experience really interesting, because I find that when you talk to audiences, it's the same thing. When you talk to people who have seen your show or listen to your podcast or read your book, and they say, oh, why did you use those words? Or why did you use that piece of information? And then you start to think, that's a good point. Why did I use those words? And then you find yourself learning from them. Even now, you find yourself thinking, actually, next time I do that, I will take that on board. And if a performer doesn't do that, if a performer doesn't engage with the audience, you don't learn either. And I think I still, even at my age now, I love learning. I love discovering new things. I love watching documentaries. I love watching books that have been recommended to me. I listen to Radio 3 because I love classical music, but I haven't got a musical bone in my body. So, but I love discovering things. So I'll find myself, you know, I'll be doing the washing up, listening to a piece of music, and then they will discuss how that piece of music was evolved. And I will stop washing up and listen to it, because I think it's really important to learn. And I think so many people who run businesses and so many people who are senior business people lose that ability to keep learning.
Fascinating. By the way, what you're talking about, I think in the broadest sense, which I think is wonderful, is attitude. You have the Americans have a saying, which is your attitude dictates your altitude. If you have an attitude whereby, you see, I walk into every room, I do a lot of conference stuff and everything, and I assume everybody is lovely.
Yeah.
Because what's the alternative?
Yeah.
You know, everybody's a bastard in there. You know,
yeah, I think that's really interesting that I live. I'm not saying I moved to this house because of this, but I live 200 yards away from an off license. And it's run by these two chaps from Ethiopia who I now adore. They're both obsessed with football. They're both. I could be in there for an hour sometimes talking about football. One's an Arsenal fan, one's a Man United fan, but they both love Palace now because of me. We talk, and you'll often go in there and they'll be arguing about Wisler Krakow with some Polish kids. It's like that's a good way. But again, it's a communication thing. But right from the start, when I first started to go in there, they loved my dad, for example. So I'd go in there with my dad, and literally the second time I went in with dad, they gave him a miniature bottle of Jameson's because he mentioned that was his favourite whiskey. They gave him a bottle of Jameson's. First Christmas they were there, we had a knock on the door. And they bought us a bottle of champagne at night. And you go, well, they're an off license. It's not costing them much. But it doesn't matter how much it costs them because there are five or six off licenses in my area, but I won't go to them because I know that that's all to do with their attitude. In the same way, and this comes to humorology, I love, if there are two chip shops to choose from in a town that I visit, I'll choose the one that's got the pun in the name. Yeah? I will go to the one that says that's called By the Grace of Cod, right? I'll do it because I think if they it's the same hairdresser, if they've made the effort to come up with something that's funny, and it grabs your attention because you look at it and you smile and you think, well, that's a good start. That's a really good start. And it's the same, you do judge, you go into a shop and I wouldn't say you look forward to going to the shop, but you come out thinking, oh, what a nice bloke. He seems nice. Because he might be horrible, he might be a bastard, but he's sensible enough to know that when a customer comes in, the customer likes to be said hello to. The customer, he likes to be, you know, what you to, and it's a simple way of using humour, but it's incredibly effective.
Oh, I love that. I absolutely love that. And talking about effective ways of using humour, I'm a huge fan of your book, Who Are Ya? And I advise anybody who's got a glimmer of an interest in football to buy it, because it is a hilarious, but it's like, it's really about celebrating the joys and miseries of being a football supporter in a fascinating and fiercely funny way. Is being a football supporter the secret to long life and happiness?
Happiness, it's not always happiness, it's emotion. The part of the thing I wanted to do with the book, apart from represent fans of every club, so there's a chapter of every club, but it's also about the connectedness of football fans. As I always say to people, it's always the first point of conversation. You'll meet somebody and you go, oh, who do you support? And if they say, oh, I don't really like football, I say, well, what do you talk to strangers about at weddings then? So I remember meeting Chris Packham for the first time. We had to share a cab away from the show. And I said, you know, you football fan? He said, I don't like football. So that's like, literally, I can talk about other stuff, but it's just the way he said it that annoyed me. So I thought, well, I'm not going to talk about other stuff then. But it's about the connectedness. It's about everywhere you go, football links. And it's like the pub I spoke to, and I'm sure it's the same with you. Football fans still get a bad press. There's still a certain group of people who hear the word football fans and think they're troubled. The pub I drink in, proper working class South London boozer, and it's full of proper working class South London boozers as well. But there are accountants, there's taxi drivers, there's lawyers, there's comedians, there's TV producers, there's all sorts. And they're all brought together. They wouldn't be meeting each other were it not for football. And football fans have this connectedness. And there is this sense of, for me, the best way of describing it for me, it's the baseline of my life. In moments when I've been deeply miserable, Ali always said to me, when she was in hospital with Palace at home, she always said, go to the game. Don't sit here with me. Go to the game. And in times when I'm deeply miserable and my friends understand, right, but it is an escape. It's a cliche, but it is an escape. But it's the sense of belonging that's really important. And it's important. I love theatre. I like ballet. I went to see Swan Lake a few weeks ago at Covent Garden. I loved it. Absolutely loved it. But you don't get that same sense afterwards. You're not, everyone's not coming out talking about, oh, that brilliant bit when, whereas with football, even if you've lost, if you've drawn, if you've won, when you're coming out afterwards, the excitement, the buzz, the lows, but you're sharing them with people that you've known. We're taking the grandchildren now of people that I started going to football with when I was 8 or 9. So we've grown up together and it's always been somewhere. And for me, coming from where I'm from this nondescript part of South London that has nothing that you can really recognise unless you're from there, the fact that people say to me, oh, you're the Palace fan, that makes me so proud. It makes me so proud when people, because it's given me my identity. It's given me, it's rooted me in South London. Football's given me, I've met so many people through football that are really good friends. I remember, you probably remember this, about 15, 20 years ago, Stan Collymore, who was playing for Aston Villa at the time, publicly said that he was suffering from depression. And the attitude was, from his own manager, John Gregory, gave an interview, said, what's he unhappy about? He's playing football and he's wealthy. How can he be depressed? That was the attitude then. Football, in the past 5 years, has really led the conversation, in particular for young men, it's really led the conversation about mental health, which almost brings us back to where we start. It's about men talking to each other, simply saying, oh, I'm really not firing on all cylinders at the moment. And football's led the way. Football's led the way in saying, it's all right to say that. It's all right to say to people, oh, I just feel a bit grumpy today. I'm really, you know, I might give the pub a miss. And it's given people the tools. And so many people look to their football club for guidance. And the pandemic, one good thing came out of the pandemic, football clubs all over the country, every single football club stepped up to the plate and were fantastic, not just in practical stuff. As I always say to Steve Parrott, I said, this place should be open 14 days a week, not just once a fortnight. There should be social clubs in here. There should be lunch clubs for old people. There should be citizens' advice here. It should be a real focal hub for the community. But during the pandemic, it became that. People looked to the and you know, Palace were doing 1,500 meals a day for local communities and sending them out. You know, Palace players were donating to PPE. It became a focal point. And in particular, the issue of mental health for young men. Football's made great steps forward in looking after the mental health of its own players. And that's been extended to helping young men in particular be aware of their mental health. And I'm very proud of football for that. Football still has its issues. There aren't enough black chairmen, for example. But football, even, you know, some people might say it's a token gesture, but even taking the knee is a visible gesture that football does. And so many people look to their football club. And there will be people who are, you know, Palace is a South London working class club. There are probably fans who are racist, but because of the knee, they will think about why they're racist, and they know not to boot. And it's simple things like that. It does, football changes people's attitudes, and that's what a business can do, because it is a business at the heart of it. So Steve Parrish, the owner, is very aware of the community things. We do great stuff. The club and the foundation do great stuff in the community, but still, the role of the club is to keep making money, to keep itself going as a football club. So it is a business. It's very much a business. And football, Premier League football, is a strange business because it's a huge global brand. But despite what you think, there isn't that much money in it. So Bet365, for example, who sponsors Stoke City, they could buy and sell every club in the Premier League in terms of finances. But in terms of global branding, football is really important. And in recent years, football is a business that's used its position in the world with responsibility. And I think football deserves a lot of credit for that. And I'm very proud to be a football fan because of it. But yeah, at the heart of it, these are not things we talk about in the pub. We talk about games that we remember and games. But it's a beautiful, important thing. And it is, again, it's probably mum's equivalent of being with her brothers. I look forward, no matter what sort of mood I'm in, I can't wait to get to the pub. And I, you know, our table is always kept clear because the rest of the pub by osmosis knows that that's where we are at the back. And I can't wait to get there. And it's fantastic. And the other thing is as well that if somebody's not there, you notice and you find out why. You'll go, is everything all right? And they go, yeah, sorry, I'm lonely. So it's a strange thing to explain to people who never go to football. But as you can tell by my enthusiasm, I'm very proud of it. But at the heart of it, as I say, football is a business, and business can. So the thing that's probably most important to my life after my family is a business. And that's kind of an odd thing to say as well.
But it's beautiful. And it's a beautiful way to end this. Kevin Day, thank you so much for your humanity, your humility, but most of all, your humour. And thank you so much for being a guest on the Humorology podcast.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you. I'm not sure how much people will learn for running their own businesses. But
now,
yeah, that's brilliant. Thanks, Paul.
The Humorology podcast was hosted by Paul Barros and produced by Simon Banks. Music by Steve Hayworth, creative direction by Les Hughes, and additional research by Helen Sykes. Please remember to subscribe, like, and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. This has been a Big Sky production.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Late bloomers tend to have more curiosity. They tend to have more resilience.
There are stories and mythology that this country has woven around Black men.
This is the cavalry, right? These are the leaders, the hometown heroes and local leaders. And we are.
It's a survival mechanism to just be like, worry of the police.
What if everything we've been taught is just all wrong?
What's worth more than this fear right now?
And that rising after failure is part of the glory of being a human being.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.